And welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have a great show for you this evening. First of all, we have Ben Hansen coming up. He'll be on in just a minute, and he's going to be talking about Discovery Plus's, is that how you say that? Discovery Plus's new series is called UFO Witness. He's starring in that series. It's a great one. I can't believe some of the people they've had on that show. I was lucky enough to see the screener, but you can see it too. I've been a cable cutter since, I don't know, way back 2011 or 12 or something like that. I guess they call them cable cutters. I haven't had cable TV. I have Roku, and I just discovered that you can get Discovery Plus is only $4.99 a month. You can add that to your Roku, and this series is on it just for that alone. I got it myself today. And $6.99 if you didn't want to watch any commercials. So check that out. Ben is a former federal agent. We've talked about that before when he's been on. He was an FBI agent. He's got an amazing background. We will talk a little bit about that and about the show and witnesses and all the cases that he we won't do any spoilers if you haven't seen it. We'll try to stay away from that. But one of the episodes has Calvin Parker, and they go into the Pascagoula abduction incident. Well, Calvin will be on in about 40 minutes into the show, and he's going to remain on the show. Ben's going to say goodbye at the top of the hour. We have a really great song that we're going to be playing during the break, and it's called Blackwater Blue Moon, the Calvin Parker story, and that's by Johnny Cobb and Jerry McCoy, so that's going to play right at the top of the hour. And it's a great song. And, oh, blog this week. So we have a blog from Charles Lear, as usual. And this one is a great one. I'd love to have someone talk about this particular incident. I think it was 1965 or so. And the title of the blog is A UFO, Humanoids and Robots Near Cisco Grove, California. If you've never heard of the Cisco Grove case, it's really amazing. It looks like these creatures were, this guy climbed a tree. He was hunting, climbed a tree, tried to get away from them. And a couple of them look like these hooded figures. They were down at the bottom of the tree trying to get up. And then this robot came and sent like vapor up that knocked him out. It's an incredible story. And next week, just to let you know, we have Miguel Romero from Red Pill Junkie. He's going to be our guest next week. And for now, I will bring the one and only Ben Hansen into the show. Welcome, Ben.
Welcome. How are you doing? Oh, good, welcome good. Me. Welcome you.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, we're not seeing your camera. I'm not sure what's going on. I see you. Let me try it again. Very strange. I can see you down below with the camera. Can you turn your camera off and on again, please?
Yeah, let's try that. Hold on one second.
You'll see a little stop cam down at the bottom. Try that. Turn it back on. There you are. You're fuzzy, but you're there.
Okay. Is that? Am I still there?
I can see you. Yes. Okay. You're a little blurry, but that's fine. You're there. We know you're there. Ben, thanks so much for being on the show again. It's always I always love hanging out with you at the conferences and things like that. You're a lot of fun, and I got to meet your family last time.
And that's right. Yeah. That was Contact in the Desert?
No, that was 2019 Phoenix.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right? Yeah. Every now and then I have I get my mom or someone to come along and hang out.
Well, this was your wife and your little one at the time.
Oh, okay. That was the kid now that is a huge, he looks like a 4-year old. He's only 2.5 though.
Wow. Well, your camera's froze, but you may want to try that stop cam one more time and try it back. Okay. And see what happens. But so, Ben, for the person who's, well, it's a picture of you, and that's better than nothing. So, Ben, for the person who's never heard you on my show before, can you just quickly give a background and what got you interested in the UFO topic?
Well, UFOs have kind of been, for people who have kind of followed or not followed what I've done on TV, I've done a lot of ghost hunting, paranormal shows. I kind of joke that recently I've been appearing kind of like your next door neighbor making cameos, like in every show.
Yeah, that's right.
I appear in, you know, a lot of Bigfoot stuff and everything, but my show on Sci-Fi, Fact or Faked, what went into all sorts of things from mermaids to leprechauns to whatever. But it all really began with UFOs for me. I was like 5 years old when E.T. first came out. And so I had this love of the movies and Hollywood and alien shows. And then that led me to cutting out newspaper clippings. And, you know, while a lot of kids were interested in space, I was too, but especially like life forms and the possibility of that. And I couldn't get enough of it. So like a lot of, you know, passions in life, I kind of had to put it away. Get down to my schoolwork. Wordy. It wasn't really a thing you talked about, UFOs, because people make fun of you. Mm-hmm. And later on in life, I found myself, I guess, reinterested in the topic. And I went to school through high school, deciding at that point that I wanted to join some sort of investigation agency. And so my degree in college was geared towards that. I did criminology, sociology, and then worked for several years investigating some nasty stuff, child sex crimes and severe physical abuse. But it gave me the experience of talking to thousands and thousands of witnesses of really bad stuff. Sometimes it's really dramatic and hard for people to talk about. Hmm. And so when people ask me, well, what do you think, like, your background provided you in UFO investigations? And I say, that's probably the key thing. You don't have to have a background in criminology. You don't have to work for some of the agencies I did, you know, like state and federal for the FBI. But having that curiosity and the objectivity, because I see a lot of that now where even I have to check myself. You know, if you've seen a lot and you've heard a lot of stuff, you're inclined perhaps to see vague evidence to support your own biasness now. And you kind of have to check yourself and remain objective no matter who you're talking to. And so I still, like, you'll see me on the TV shows, like, right, taking notes. That's just a habit that I do because I kind of approach the case as if I had to go to court with it, you know. Mm. And I don't write up, you know, full on reports anymore like I used to, but I still do see it as an evidentiary kind of discovery process.
Sure. And you get to, you and I have had this conversation before, you get to learn people. And with your training, I know that one of the things that you've really looked into is you can see the telltales if someone's telling the truth or not. I'm actually taking a course on that.
Awesome.
Right now, it's really fascinating. Just the little clues that people will give you accidentally, like maybe if they'll look up to their left or, you know, all these different things. Uh-huh. You can tell if they're looking at something they're picturing or remembering. So how does that work for you? Has that helped you also when you're interviewing people in the UFO field?
Yeah, it definitely has. The thing with nonverbal communication, most of it, what we do is nonverbal. You know, they say 70% to 80%. And so it's both a habit you can form, but it's also, it's got to be deliberate. Like I could sit in a conversation with somebody and just kind of get an uneasy feeling. Like, I don't know that I'm buying what they're telling me. But you really do have to methodically look for certain things and break it down, maybe even after the fact. And so when you go through law enforcement training, it's typically why you videotape an interview and the second person is in the other room watching for these things, not just what they're saying, but they're looking for the cues, looking for stuff that doesn't mesh up. And so there is a science to it, but it's not exact. There's no sure way to tell someone's lying, but we can tell a lot of times they're uncomfortable if they're stressed. And so to be areas to further explore, and did become sort of a hobby of mine is a lot of the books that I read are, in fact, like this whole section over here is all about, you know, nonverbal communication and deceptions. And it can be very helpful when you're talking to people.
Ben, do you ever, I know it's totally off topic here, but do you ever think there'll be a day when there'll be a 100% certainty as far as lie detection? And if so, how powerful would that be? And would that change everything?
Probably not 100% certainty. I mean, because when we're getting down into looking at fMRI scans and putting people in these machines and they see different parts of their brain light up, they think that is a closer representation. But because people process information differently, again, we're probably only able to say they're more stressed about this. We don't know why. Plus, you have people with different psychological makeups. Sociopaths, for example, they don't react the same way when they tell a lie as a normal person would, you know? Right. And so, I mean, you're probably getting into the Minority Report. Remember that movie with Tom Cruise? And it's like, if you could tell someone's lying, right? Maybe we can predict if they're about to commit a crime too, because you know their intent. And that would be kind of freaky, because then we're putting people in the prison for crimes they haven't committed yet or lies they haven't told yet, you know?
So yeah.
Really sci-fi.
And I know, you know, our guest coming up, you know, Charles Hickson, I know after the Pascagoula incident, he took he passed a lie detector test. And, you know, the critics were saying something like, you know, that person that performed the test wasn't that experienced or whatever, so we can't rely on that. But are they somewhat reliable in general, a polygraph?
Yeah, and we ran into the same thing with the Travis Walton case, and I talk a lot about that in his documentary. On a bad day, okay, a bad day, if you give any validity to the polygraph, you're talking about 80%, they say. The white paper studies have shown that it's about 80% accurate. And on a good day, they say as much as 95%. Now, I don't know about that, but you're within that range. The problem with the polygraph is it convicts or says that more people are lying than not lying. So you get a lot more, what would that be, a negative, not a false positive, but a false negative, I think is how it would work. So at any rate, that's why a lot of truth tellers get caught up as being liars in a polygraph. But the other way around, somebody who's telling, it would be harder for a liar to be passed as telling the truth, if that makes sense. Hmm. So it errs more on the side of favoring the truth tellers, or I'm sorry, the liars, as opposed to the other way around. So there is some validity, I think, but the reason it's not accepted in most states in court is because there's just too much of an error factor. And so it's used more as a tool for them to say, hey, let's ask this person more questions about this topic. And it's corroborating evidence rather than like a just direct, you know, this is true or not. And so it is helpful. And what was the most helpful is if you take more than one witness and you have them tested multiple times, the compounding statistical evidence of it is incredible. And that's what happened in Travis Walton's case.
Yeah,
you have seven crew members and they all take it and pass it multiple times. If you believe in the polygraph at all, the chances they're lying is one in millions, if not billions.
Wow. Wow. Isn't that something? Dave Altman says hi to you.
Oh, hey, Dave.
Yeah. Crazy Dave, they call him, right, Dave? He'll love that I said that. So let's talk about the show. Now, I believe you told me, and by the way, your camera works about once every 30 seconds or so.
Oh, no. Man. Yeah.
But we know you're there. So did you tell me, maybe a few years ago that you were getting involved in the show? You said, I can't tell you what it is, but it's going to be about UFOs. I believe this was this show you were talking about.
Yeah, it probably was, because we filmed most of the UFO Witness starting in November of 2019.
Yep.
We got to about February, March, 2020, and then COVID shut us down. We got back in there June and July and finished up. So yeah, it's been well over a year now.
Yeah. Wow. And so you wrapped up the season basically in June and July.
Yeah, we had some very restrictive measures that we had to follow to finish up, you know, back east. And we were lucky enough to be able to do that because it's, you know, like it's been such a journey putting the whole thing together. And, you know, the way that they typically film is you'll do a season of something and within about 3 or 4 months it starts airing. Right. Mm-hmm. And so this one was such a longer process that a lot of us were just wondering, okay, well, you know, where is it going to finally show up? We have so many great stories to tell, so many things that are left. We want to get to these ones, but as networks go, you know, we got to wait and see how this airs and how it does, but we're ready to go for season two. I mean, I'm not announcing it, not by any means. We're ready. We have so much, the response on this from the media, and from the viewers has been amazing.
I'd like to talk about some of the episodes and some of the great witnesses that you have, but I also want to be careful not to, you know, spoil it for someone. So we just have to, and I'm sure you realize that too. So we have to treat it kind of delicately, but, one of the people, I want to say, Jenny, and it's Zai. I'm trying to remember her last name from Zyben. Blue. Zyben. Yeah. That was awesome. And I understand that she passed away, right?
She did. And, just on your other note, the network has told me we can get into, some in-depth stuff on the episodes if you want. I'm not going to, you know, give away everything, but we can talk about what they're about, kind of some discoveries. That's fine.
Okay.
Jenny Zeidman, yes, she was a personal assistant and field investigator with J. Allen Hynek, Project Blue Book. And so try to remember, she was 80, don't remember, 84 or is it 87? She was up there in years, and she hadn't ever really come forward and talked about the inner conversations and dealings with Hynek and her time at Blue Book. So we were lucky enough to be able to connect with her through Mark O'Connell, who wrote a biography on Hynek. And it was unfortunate. I really wish we had more time with her, but we were probably a couple months into it, and she got sick pretty quickly, and then she passed. And And we're seeing so much of that with these people who were, I mean, we've only got a few witnesses left to Roswell, you know, before we lose them. Right. And so many people that it's kind of like, you're hoping some of these, there she is. Yeah. We're hoping that some of the, military officials, those who are involved in some of these earlier incidents, we're hoping that before they go to their deathbed, that they also will disclose. And some of that's some of the most powerful testimony. Why would you lie to your own children and to people about these things, knowing that you're going to be leaving this world soon? And like in the case of my grandfather, it's like, that's why deathbed confessions, have special, latitude, you know, when it comes to the law and what they allow in courts because of that circumstance.
Absolutely. And I would like to talk a little bit about your grandfather and your father, but before we get there, something you just touched on, and that is, I remember the gentleman's name was Mark, and his father was in the military, and he had those documents when it came to, he actually said that his father told his children that he saw aliens when it came to the Roswell crash. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I was thinking about this today because every now and then, and I don't like bantering on Twitter or Facebook, but I do appreciate skeptical, perspectives, and I consider myself skeptical, but what I mean is there's this gentleman on there. I was talking about the recent disclosure that happened with Tony Bregaglia and the FOIA request that he got back. And someone jumped in there and in the exchange said, well, there's none of this is proven. There's absolutely no evidence that the government has debris or that this is alien. And I thought about Mark Magruder. I said, wait, I don't have time to debate this. But if you care to know, is what I was thinking, if you care to look into this, look at examples like Mark Magruder, whose dad was a decorated World War II pilot. And in the episode that you're referring to, I think is episode number two or five. Before he died, he sat down with his sons and started to tell them about this second career that he had in the military, a second sort of secret, you know, role that he had. And he was invited to what's called the Air War College. So this is 1948. Okay, Roswell happened in the summer of 47, so the spring of 48. He's invited back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. They took a lot of these high-ranking officers, colonels. I think it was a colonel at the time. And they wanted their opinion on what they called the problem, the situation, I think is what it was. Hmm. And they showed them debris from Roswell. They were told it came from Roswell. Okay, so there you have confirmation the government, yes, did take the debris, not a weather balloon. He handled the debris. He handled the hull of the craft they were told came from Roswell. He rocked it back and forth. They had it there on the ground. And he saw at least two different occupants, that one was dead and the other was still alive. And his description was it was similar humanoid, but it was definitely not human. And so he goes on and on over the couple months left of his life and tells his kids as they're asking him questions. And sometimes he would answer, sometimes he'd be vague. But why would you lie to your kids about something like this? He felt like he needed to maintain his oath. He wasn't going to go tell the world about it. But, you know, it's World War II heroes and people who are in that era that are coming out, have come out, have discussed this. And we think that for, you know, of course, Roswell probably was one of those keystone moments where the government really became involved.
Right. Right. And, you know, you just mentioned witnesses. Are there any, there was one or two witnesses left from Roswell, right? And you didn't get to interview. I mean, are they still available to interview?
I think I've spoken on another project through Don Schmidt, who connected us. It was I think that was part of the CW show that we did. I was able to meet one of the last witnesses. I want to say, oh gosh, her name escapes me. It's not Freddie. I can't remember. I'm sorry, but she was a child at the time. Her dad was I think he was the fire department, like the chief battalion. Or if not the chief of Roswell Fire Department. And he responded to the crash wreckage. He snuck away some of the pieces of it and then was able to show his family and brought it back to them. And so when word of this reached the military base and they started sending people out to tie up the loose ends, they got a visit from, I think he was an intelligence officer stationed there. And he separated her from her family, took her to the other room, threatened her, basically said, hey, if you talk about what you saw and what your dad brought home, you'll never see your family again. We'll take you out to the desert and leave you or kill you. So she must have only been, I think, like 6-7 years old is what I'm remembering.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Yes. And she was in tears, okay, telling this story after so many years. To hear her tell the story and still have the terror, that emotional impact, okay, from a little child, And this intelligence officer probably didn't like doing that, but it was his job. And he felt like this was such of a national importance that they had to go to such extremes. So that has to tell you something. If they're willing to threaten kids, that they're going to kill them or their families, this was no joke. It wasn't a weather balloon. It wasn't any of the things the Air Force officially says it was. So she was one of the last ones. I don't know if she's still alive, but now you only have kids of, you know, or grandkids, really, of most of the witnesses that are still around.
Right. And Roswell is so confusing to me. You know, there's so many elements that are mysterious. And, you know, one of them, and I've had a talk with Alejandro Rojas, you know, basically thinks that Roswell was a nothing burger type of thing. But there's so many things about it that are big question marks for me. First of all, the thing I say when I talk to a skeptic about that, why would they even put it out there that the Army Air Force, you know, captured a disc? I mean, there was no reason for them to put that out there in the press to begin with. I mean, just that alone, and the skeptics have said something, well, it's better that than let them look at that and think about that instead of the mogul, you know, that was put up to spy on Russian, you know, nuclear development. You know,
they didn't have the machine in place yet. And what I mean by that, I see the comments, people reminding me, thank you. It was Freddie. I said Freddie. It's Frankie Rowe. And it looks like she did pass away in 97 or 2017. Oh. Yeah, they didn't have the machine work of deniability and cover up in place. And you know, like people get out, oh, conspiracy. Look, it was so much easier to pull off a conspiracy back then. Why? Because I think we had more of a trust for our government.
Absolutely.
Nobody really questioned, you know, like, and if there was a lie, people believed that, well, the government has to do certain things, but we trust the people who are doing it. And so you didn't have many leaks. You didn't have many people coming out that, especially if you're threatening people their lives. It wasn't until the story broke in the 80s, you know, Stan Friedman and the Roswell story. It wasn't really until then that the people felt comfortable they could actually start coming out and talking about this, because they thought there was a moratorium and that they would lose their livelihood, their pensions, they would be killed. And so it took a long time for that to stop. And so when you have a press release that comes out immediately and says, yeah, got a UFO, I don't think that the people making the press releases thought that it was wrong to say that. That summer was filled with UFO sightings. You right. know, you had some in Arizona, you had some alleged crashes, you had, you know, Kevin Arnold, you know, and
yeah, now you got me. Arnold, yes, was his last name. In the Northwest.
Yeah, gosh, what could
God, what is right? It's both of us. It's contagious. I wanted to say Keith Arnold, but that's not it either.
You know, somebody's going to jump in here. It's like the
yeah,
first
and they're going to hammer us. You know, crazy.
Like, oh, you idiots.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking
Kenneth.
It up.
Thank Kenneth. You, Kenneth Arnold.
I was so close. Kenneth, yeah. Thank you. Sorry. I just
finished
a book about that too from his daughter. So anyways, Keith Arnold, Kenneth Arnold. So anyways, that whole summer leading up to it, there was a lot of hysteria about UFOs to begin with. And so when somebody, you know, like a rancher comes into town and says, I found this weird thing, and the public relations officer goes out with them and they, you know, they check this out, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, I don't think even that they made that decision on their own. Higher ups had to approve it. But I don't think anyone thought, hey, maybe we shouldn't say anything. They were all caught up in the emotion. It was like, yeah, tell the world we got one. All right, what's wrong with that? This information belongs to us all. We have made contact. And it wasn't until after the fact you know, when the debris gets over to Texas, was it made a couple stops, Kansas, Texas, where they put the quash on it and say, whoa, hey, you know, and we have witnesses that say they saw the evidence it was switched out with, where the real debris went. So when somebody tells me there's no evidence that the government has UFO debris, they just haven't looked at all at anything that we have available to us as far as witnesses go. I don't know what they want. Do they want it actually in an official government document? Well, we've got those two. Look at John Greenwald and, you know, what he's turning up right now with the CIA archives. The government has debris from so-called UFOs. Now, is it alien? That's where we do have to make these implications based on witness testimony, based on the people who were there who saw it. What do you want them to do? Come out with the official government statement. The debris, you know, came from an alien creature that we have here. It's in the possession of the United States. They're not going to do that. That's where the machine went to work.
Right, right. We have a question up there. Adam wants to know if there's any idea where the Roswell wreckage might be right now. And that's that would be all speculative.
It's very speculative. And I okay, at the risk of being attacked by everybody here. the book The Day After Roswell is a great book to read. Okay, it's by Philip Corso. And William Burns, you know, from UFO Hunters. Now, before Corso died, he claimed that he didn't get to proofread the whole book and that Bill Burns, you know, put most of the stuff in there because there are some inaccuracies. The problem is we don't know where. Now, Philip Corso did work for the Pentagon. He worked in research and development for the Army primarily, I believe. And his theory, which he claims he was a part of actually, was to take the material from Roswell and start distributing it, outsourcing it to third-party private contractors. Okay, so that's where you get the, I don't call it a legend or a rumor. According to him, it's fact. But we had advancements in night vision, fiber optics, microchips, and all these things that came from it. But I whether that's completely true or partially true, I do think there's good evidence that a lot of this material did go to private contractors. Hmm. And if there is a secret keeper, I don't know if it's one group anymore. I think that a lot of it probably went to places like Lockheed and a lot of Battelle, for example. We talk about that in our show. Battelle, did a lot of metallurgy analysis, and we came up with materials like nitinol. You know, and if you talk to Tony Bergaglia, who just got the FOIA request back on this, they talk about the memory shape metals that we know the government was testing. We know that, right? And so we kind of developed our own version of it through nitinol. Which if you, I don't have a pair of my glasses here, but if you have your sunglasses or eyeglasses and you can twist the rims of them and bend them, that's nitinol. That supposedly came from the analysis of this memory metal, which we now can do things with and bend. So to answer your question, where is it is completely speculative, except we do know that a bulk of it went to Wright-Patterson. I think that's pretty well established just based on people who saw it there, people who worked on it there. From there, it's kind of rumored, you know, maybe some went to the different contractors or, you know, when Area 51 was established, you know, to help in their research there. So who knows?
One of the, cases that you dive into in one of the episodes, I think it's the second or third one, is Kecksburg, which I've always loved that one. And I've had Stan Gordon on a number of times. But you went there, which is great. You got to do that. You found a Pepsi can when you were looking at the crash site. But it was great that I was thinking when the two witnesses brought you into the woods there, how would anyone remember the way, you know, the forests changed over the years, and you're a kid, and how could they possibly remember exactly where that thing landed? That's kind of, yeah, go ahead.
I was so stoked to actually get to Kecksburg and to have someone even direct me towards a very general location, because if you look at the landscape, the things that don't change are the hillside. And if I could, I don't know how much of that was covered in the actual show, but there's a hill that goes down. You can see it from one road, and then there's a private property from the backside that goes down. And in this little valley is this, a lot of, I guess it would be like scrub oak and some trees like that. And there's a trail that is, you could see it's grown over, but vehicles could go down in there. Right. And so, from a couple different witnesses, and the one, who lived right across the property from it, and where, I don't think his house is there anymore, but they were very confident that it was within a couple hundred yards, okay, of this location. And so my goal when I got there was to look at the trees and say, okay, look, could any of these trees actually have been here? And there's some sizable ones that definitely would have been there. And you could look at the tree rings and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So we knew that we were in the general area. And then, you know, some of the larger trees did look like, you know, that if they had been around for 60 years or so, that they were kind of chopped off, you know, at the top and kind of bent over. And it's speculative, but in my brain, I'm thinking, man, if something had come crashing down here, could it have left kind of lopped off trees that just stopped growing and died, you know, in that area? And that's where we started searching. And I really wish I had more time there, because with permission from the owners, I would tear the place up.
Sure, get an excavator in there. And, well, a little at a time, gently, you know, with metal detection and all that. You know, underground radar, whatever they call that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I see people commenting here about the soda cans and the pull tabs. Yeah. pulling up that Pepsi can, I'm glad they included that in the edit. You know, it was because I was actually there on the site Googling, you know, how old is a Pepsi can that still had the tab on it, and trying to look it up to get an idea of how long that thing had been there.
And it could have been the 70s, early 70s, right?
That's what I got to. I think in the 70s is about that is when they stopped using that. So maybe it was an era of Kecksburg, but what it said was this area, first of all, the topsoil, it wasn't that well. I did dig a lot. And I actually gave the shovel to one of the crew guys. You didn't see it. I'm like, come on, guys. We don't have to film me doing all of this. You
did.
That's
right. Yeah. You need a body double in there doing it. Hey. Before we're going to bring Calvin in just a minute, but before that, just a couple things. First of all, I had no idea that there was a Men in Black story about that. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that or not, but that kind of shocked me because I never heard that before. But the other thing is, before we bring Calvin in, I'd like for you to talk about the episode with your father, because I thought that was really, really good. Because you have told me this exact story before, and hang in there, Calvin, we'll bring you in a bit. But Ben, you've told me the story about your grandfather before, and it's such a moving story. For the person that hasn't heard this, can we talk about that episode? And you actually filmed your father talking about this. It was really, that's my favorite episode because of that.
Yeah, I really like the way that the editors handled it. Because a lot of our show has, you know, creepy and moving and powerful music to kind of help get you through the stories. And it really kind of slowed down in this part because I don't know if you can tell in the edit, but, you know, I wasn't crying, but I could tell my eyes were getting kind of watery hearing this, because I've heard that part of the story a few times from my dad. I didn't have all the details that he gave me, but basically my grandpa worked for the Air Force as a civil engineer, and he worked out of Hill Air Force Base in Utah, and at about 1965 was the first time my dad remembers him coming to him and saying, hey, son, I'm going to be on a special assignment for the Air Force, and occasionally I could be called out to some location. I may not be able to tell you where I'm going or when I'm coming back. And this was Cold War era, and my dad's like, you mean like a nuclear war thing? And he's like, something like that. So in the summer of 65, I think was the first time that he got a call, and my dad would sometimes have to drive him to the airport or to the Air Force base, get on a flight, and he'd be gone for sometimes 2, 3, 4 weeks. And so to kind of summarize what happened here was he was unavailable by phone. My grandpa told him that he was working underground when he was at Wright-Patterson, which is where the Foreign Technology Division is for the Air Force. And he was underground doing things. He would never talk about what he did. He remembers he was alone a lot. He was very lonely, he said, where he worked. And he only knew people by first names. And so as my grandpa got older, he developed prostate cancer. Hmm. And eventually spread to his brain. And my dad would go over and like watch TV shows with him. And one of the big shows at the time was Unsolved Mysteries. Hmm. And, this is when they started talking about Roswell and stuff in the late '80s, early '90s. My dad was like, hey, wait a second. Weren't you at Wright-Patterson? And they're saying this debris went to Wright-Patterson. And, I don't have time to get all the details of it, but talking about Philip Corso, Philip shows up on the screen, and my grandpa's like, oh, it's old Phil. Haven't seen him in a while. My dad's like, you know this guy?
Wow.
And so that was kind of another little weird thing. But he would ask him questions, and he would ask him about aliens. He'd ask him if this stuff was true. And he's like, you worked there. Didn't you know something? And for the longest time, my grandpa would laugh. He changed the subject, and one day he actually got really mad, and he got up and he said, look, we've got to get out of here. They were at the gym at the time. And so this went on until they didn't really talk about it for some time, and he's on his deathbed. And this is the story my dad tells in the episode, and he's holding his hand, and my grandpa is just within a couple hours. I didn't make it to the hospital. I was on a date actually, and I meant to stop at the hospital on my way home. But my dad had this time alone, and he looks at him and says, son, I know what you've been asking me, and I want you to know that we're not alone. And he knows that my grandpa was saying this in the context of the question about life on other worlds. He wasn't asking about life after death. They all believed, you know, we've always believed that. But he said, I want you to know we're not alone. Take care of your mother. Everything's going to be okay. And he shortly passed away after that. And so that episode really dives into my dad and I trying to match up some dates, trying to figure out if there's a timing of when my grandpa was going out there, what he may have been working on, what was this special team he was a part of. Why was he underground when Wright-Patterson to this day denies they have an underground complex, which is just laughable. I mean, come on. Hmm. You know, all these different things. And it's been kind of our journey together.
Yeah. Well, it's a great episode. The way that all played out, it was very moving. Don't you wish your grandfather could have just talked to you? I mean, I know they're sworn to secrecy and all that, but it sure would have been nice to know. You probably, he'd probably say something like, but don't ever share it on a podcast UFO.
Or left a note or something that we could discover later, you know?
Yeah.
Then he wouldn't maybe be violating his oath belt, you know, just leave us some clue and clues. Well,
that statement he made was quite the statement. And so we're going to bring in our guest, Calvin Parker. Welcome to the show, Calvin.
Thank you. How are y'all doing?
We're doing great here. Yeah.
I've been sitting here listening to Ben. That's pretty interesting.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we never had time to get into that when I was out there with you. It's
no,
kind of my, my personal connection to all this. But, you know, I was into UFOs a lot before I even knew that my grandpa had a connection. So maybe it runs in the blood.
Along those lines, Ben, did you said you watched like Unsolved Mysteries or something like that. Did your grandfather react to any of these type of shows, you know, when you were getting there?
Yeah, it was one of his favorite shows. And they had this system kind of worked out, which Mark Magruder and his dad, he said it was kind of the same thing where my grandpa would sit in his recliner. My dad would bring in like, it was usually like a ham and cheese sandwich and a drink, and they'd sit down and watch it together. And my dad would say like, do you think that's real? Do you think that they really brought debris there? And if it was yes, my grandpa would go, that's interesting. And then every now and then he'd go like, oh no, that's completely idiotic. That's stupid. And so he wasn't telling him, but he would confirm that, you know, like I think that might be on the right track sort of thing, you know. And that was kind of their code. He felt like that he was getting information.
How about that? Oh, so Calvin, again, welcome to the show. We're going to be going right through the next hour, but so I don't know which one of you want to talk about it, but you are in one of the episodes and you did an episode together. And so Ben, how did all that work out?
So I'll tell you kind of how we met Calvin, and I'm not sponsoring Subway here. I'm just going to take a little drink.
Okay.
It's getting a little bit dry. But if Subway wants to sponsor us, feel free. So we were doing an episode on abduction cases and looking at different features of different types of entities that are reported. I, of course, had heard of the Pascagoula case, but I honestly didn't know much about it. And I think Calvin would agree here. When he first came out and began sharing a story, there was so much almost revulsion against a lot of what they had to say, because it didn't fit the traditional, if there was a traditional sort of, you know, description of entities at the time. And it was very bizarre. And they got ridiculed so much so that, and Calvin can tell you more about that, but he went kind of into hiding. He didn't want to talk about this. And so the story wasn't as front and center. It didn't, like Travis Walton's case, you know, eventually they did a movie on it. They did all this stuff, and Travis tried to hide too. He didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
But with Calvin, I didn't know much about the story. And as I always try to have an objective mind, if you look at what happened to these two men, it sounds like a sci-fi movie. But if you withhold your judgment and you get to meet someone such as Calvin and talk to him, he is the most humble, straight-earth guy. He and his wife are just... Oh. You just get this vibe that, you know, everyone's capable of lying, but if there was somebody who you would least ever suspect, it would be Calvin. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's the vibe I got from him when I heard his story, and I learned the evidence surrounding the case, how law enforcement was involved, how the military was very interested in what they had to say. How you have two witnesses, you have then other witnesses who saw the craft, you know, in the area. It builds a very strong case. And so I to me, Calvin Parker's incident is a testament to me that no matter how bizarre the story sounds, you've got to spend the time and look at the ancillary witnesses, the other evidence, and talk to the person themselves if available. And then it may not start. So it was a great this episode when we're trying to figure out you know, if there's a pattern from back then to now, and if people are still having similar experience.
Yeah, Ben, you're cutting out a lot. We really can't do much about that. There's only 4 minutes left to this segment anyway. And we're going to dive right into Calvin's story in the next hour. But Calvin actually approached me after a blog came out back in 2013. But Calvin, you hadn't talked to anyone. I mean, I was the first one to get you back. I mean, on the air in years, right?
Oh, absolutely. We met at the conference, whichever one.
You've gone to
in Arizona, yeah. And it was just a bond, kind of. I got up on stage and told my little story, and Martin met us afterwards. And just so happened that Paul Hynek was there.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
We had an interview coming up. I said, can Paul sit in on this? Oh, absolutely. Come on. And we all formed a little bond right there, you know, where we got to meet, got to know each other. And
that's right.
That show done me more good in Arizona than any of them have, for opening me up and letting me talk, where a lot of people would go on stage and go up and go to bed and forget about it. I wanted to meet people. I got out in the crowd, mingled a little bit, talked, and met some of the nicest people I've ever seen in my life there.
Yeah.
And if I was don't ever go to another conference, it would be that one also.
Yeah. So Ben, we have just 2 minutes, 2 minutes left, unfortunately. But, so you got down there, and, did you ever look into any, we're going to be talking about this in the next hour, but did you ever look into anything like the secret tape the police recorded and things like that when you were looking into this case?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the episode, they play some of that audio, if I remember correctly. It was circulating online somewhere. Somebody has a copy, but I can't remember if it showed up in the episode.
That's right. It's bad audio. The audio is really tough to hear. But it's,
And I'm sure you guys will talk about that. But that also was something that really pushed Dr. Hynek into believing the case, because it was a surreptitious recording, and a lot of times you will capture, you know, in a criminal situation, you know, the culprit is talking about something once they don't think it's in there, like, let's keep our story straight sort of thing.
Right.
But you hear the genuineness of the fear and what the two were discussing when they didn't know they were being recorded. And so it's probably illegal to do so in the state. to do that now, but it's a good thing that they were doing it, because it kind of really supports that idea that this was a genuine encounter and got Dr. Hynek to back them up.
You know, if I don't say nothing else, I have the full tape now where when you walk in the sheriff department and they interviewed us both separate, that's all on tape beside the secret room. And a secret tape that they thought is also on it. So I was able to get all that original reel to it.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. And I'm going to try to look at it, and I'll get y'all a copy and send it to you.
All right. Well, Ben, thank you so much. Calvin, you're going to hang in there. Ben, I really appreciate it. It's always always nice talking to you, and always nice seeing you as well when that can happen. And so, again, it's Discovery Plus. The new series is UFO Witness, and check that out. You can get that online streaming. And thanks so much, Ben.
You're welcome. Thanks, Martin, and thanks, Calvin. We'll catch up with you later.
You're welcome. Nice
all right, everyone.
To you again, Ben.
You
so,
too.
So here is the treat. We got in the break here. We're going to be playing a little thing called Blackwater Blue Moon. That's the Calvin Parker story. This is a song by Johnny Cobb and Jerry McCoy. Here we go.
Black water, blue moon, strange things happening in Pascagoula. It was an October night, fishing on a Mississippi riverbank. Sky lit up, time stood still, my whole world changed. It's my will with that black water and a blue moon. The silence is louder than thunder and June. Black water, blue moon, some strange things happening in Pascagoula. Same. Will folks believe or think I'm insane? Oh, things still a mystery. Why they took my friend and me? There was black water and a blue moon. Silence is louder than thunder and June. Black water, blue moon. Strange things happening in Pascagoula.
I noticed blue hazy lights reflected coming across from my back, out across the water. A real bright beam appeared all over us, but it kind of blinded me for a second. And when I got my vision back, I seen three bulky looking creatures coming toward us, telepathically telling, you know, don't be afraid, we're not going to hurt you. You can't really pin everything down, you don't really know. And that's the point I'm holding now. I don't know what happened. I know something happened.
I ran from my fears nearly all of my life. I couldn't tell anyone, not even my wife.
Welcome back. I have Calvin Parker on. Calvin, how are you? Good to have you back here.
Great. And it's good to be back, Martin.
You know, since you've been on the last time, a lot of things have happened. We can talk about that. But some interesting on my side is I never really looked into the early part of the reporting on your story. And so thanks to Philip Mantle and some of the stuff that he's helped, along with a great website. And there's a great page, and there's an awful lot of research that I was never even aware of at the time. And I'll see if I can figure that out. I can actually bring that up possibly. It doesn't look like I have it right here. But there's a lot of research of the, for instance, a document came forward that actually when they examined you, they found puncture wounds on your left arm, I believe, and actually on your leg. And also Charles, he had puncture marks on him as well when he was examined.
Yeah, both of us did. And I felt like we had some kind of injection there, but didn't say nothing. Then once we got to the Sangin River Hospital, and then Dr. Hynek, Sanders, and Harker, you know, they just verified, yeah, that's some kind of injection mark.
Wow.
So yeah. Just, I think that was more or less to relax us. Because when they did that, I really didn't care what was happening.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing.
That's what I was reading. And this, what I read was your interview right away with the sheriff that night. When he interviewed you, I read the transcript of that, and you know, everything that you've talked about over the years is right there. The one part that's, they left the room. You didn't know that they were recording you, and you and Charles go right into this thing and how you were just a wreck, basically. I mean, you said you needed something to calm your nerves, and nobody's going to believe you. And this is when all the while, you had no idea that you were being recorded. And
no, absolutely not.
It's so great that the police officer had the foresight to do that, and that it's now it's a record. Unfortunately, you can't understand much of it when you're listening, but I did listen to it a couple of times as a 30-minute tape. That also is the interview, and then it goes into, you know, you or when he left the room. And again, hard to listen to, but one of the things that I never heard you talk about is Charles turns around, he sees you there, and your arms are up in the air. And you say that you know, when you're talking to him about it in private, you basically say, I couldn't move my arms. It was like I was bit by a rattlesnake. There was nothing you could do.
Yeah. And that's what it, you know, that's how scared I was at the time. My arms were stretched out toward the river, almost in the same spot they put me back in. And that's when Charlie said, well, you know, we need to let somebody know. No, we don't need to let nobody know. I don't want nobody to know that I was even there. And Charlie snuck around and, you know, made the phone calls.
If you, are you glad that it was that you were able to talk about it?
Oh, very, very happy to be able to talk about it.
Is it almost therapeutic in a way?
In a way, yeah. And, like everybody else, I'm still hunting answers. And the best thing that happened to me when you put me in touch with Philip Mantle. And we sat down and talked, and he finished it off. He wanted me to do a book. He said, that's your legacy. So I got to believing it was my legacy, and I guess it was, to do it. Now, you reach a time and point with all this going on in the world, you kind of get burnt out on it a little bit. Yeah. And I'm right here at that point, and I'm going to have to take a little short vacation.
Sure.
Before I get back to it. But I've got my houseboat ready. Matter of fact, I went down and spent the night on it in case electricity went out.
Oh, my goodness. You know, when people say a houseboat, you just picture a houseboat. You showed me a picture of this thing. That's a house mansion. That thing is huge. How big is that thing?
Oh, it's 120 foot long.
I mean, who has a 120 foot houseboat?
Yeah, three stories.
That's amazing.
A 10G generator. And I always keep it ready. And I knew last night if the electricity went off, I'd go down there and crank it. And we'd have electricity and heat and water and hot water. But my wife and my mother didn't want to go. And I said, well, y'all got one chance. I'm going. And it's not but about 600 foot from the house.
Oh, really? It's that close?
Yeah. So I had a friend that come by that pretty much didn't have nowhere warm to stay. And I said, I tell you what, come stay with me. I got three bedrooms, big bedrooms. You just take any one you want. So we spent the night down there. Wow. But I didn't let them know. I kept coming up here and checking on them, too.
Calvin, I neglected to, and I do this often, I neglected the new listener to the show, the new listener that may have not have heard the Pascagoula incident. Some people are probably out there rolling their eyes right now. They know the story. They've heard it a bunch of times. But can you, in a nutshell, for the person that's never heard about the incident, can you just kind of try to make a 5 or 10 minute at the most nutshell of what happened?
Absolutely. I was working in the oil field, going to get married in October. This was October, going to get married in November. So I was needing another job because all I was doing was staying gone, putting in hours. So I called, Daddy told me to call up Charles Hickson and talk to him. He said, yeah, son, come on down. I can give you a job fitting, ship fitting if you can weld. I said, we'll get through that. So I loaded up, went down there, and he had a room for rent, and I leased a room for him. Well, the next day, we get up to go to work. So I went and got my brass, my physical. That was the second physical I had, first physical I had that day. But anyhow, we brassed in, worked all day. And when we was getting off work, this was in October the 11th now, my first day at work. He said, would you like to go fishing? Well, I ain't never fished too much down here. And said, yeah, we'll go fishing. He said, well, I don't have no fishing equipment, Charlie. Let's run by my house and pick some up and you use some of mine. Well, a man from the South just don't offer us fishing equipment, period, because it just don't happen. So we went by and picked it up, and we drove to a place called the Grain Elevator. And it used to be where they unload ships and that grain would fall off, and the fish would feed there. But the bugs were so bad. It was probably 72 degrees that day, I think. The bugs were so bad we couldn't stand them. So he said, let's go to the Shaw Peters Shipyard and try it there. Well, we pulled up. There was a no trespassing sign, bunch of debris on the ground. And I said, why don't they keep this place up? He said, because this washes in and it don't wash back out. And there's one thing that I would like to clear up that I never have cleared up there. People saying, well, you wasn't seen on the cameras. Well, heck no, I wasn't seen on the cameras. It was an abandoned shipyard. They didn't have cameras.
So, oh, yeah, that isn't a lot of places have talked about why didn't they see you or the toll booth cameras too, or I believe.
Yeah, they didn't have cameras in the toll booth. It was manned all the time. So I just wanted to clear that up because it's come up and, I hadn't confronted them about it. But anyhow, we got our equipment. We walked down to the pier, and I was afraid of fishing on no trespassing, where they had them no trespassing signs. Charlie, don't worry about it. So I went down with him. So I had to trust him to put my life of being out of jail there. We sat down. I was looking across the river. And there was no Noah ship or maybe a Coast Guard ship or something there tied up. And to myself, I was just sitting there thinking, starting a new job. I seen how thick that steel was now. Well, I was thinking, how does steel float in this stuff like it? And that's what was on my mind. Then all of a sudden, coming across behind me, across the river where Johnny Cobb got that little information from the song, where the light showed up coming from behind me across the river, I turned around and looked, and I thought it was a law. I said, well, they're here to put us in jail, Charlie. About that time he turned around, there was a bright light, one of the brightest lights I've ever seen, shined on us. And it just blinded us almost. And before we could, that's actually what the craft looked like to me.
So for those of you in YouTube, the reason he stopped there is because this is a drawing that you actually did.
Yes, sir.
And how long ago did you do that drawing? Was this from, was it right after or was it a long time after?
That was with Dr. Hynek.
Oh, wow.
That night.
Really? Wow.
Yes, sir. So when this bright light shined on us, I noticed three bulky looking creatures coming. They was big, ugly, bulky creatures. And they, two of them got a hold of Charlie and one got a hold of myself. Yeah, that kind of favors the creatures a little bit. But, they got a hold of myself, got a hold of Charlie. Well, they took me on toward the ship, got up in front of the door, and that's when I noticed the lights wasn't a beam. It was coming out of the ship. Looked like it was inside the walls or something. And then when I went inside, you know, the bright spotlight just kind of shut out. And I seen these illuminating lights. Well, this big ugly thing turned left, went down the hallway, and took a right just a few feet down there. And while I was looking in, I noticed an examination table. Well, this creature, the big ugly one, carried me over, laid me on my back, didn't strap me down or nothing right then. And there was something about the size of a deck of cards. The bottom of it was blue. I could see that. Come down about a foot in front of my head and started rotating. It rotated four times. It clicked four times. Then it shot back up into the ceiling. Well, I noticed he backed off. But what I didn't know then, when they picked us up, they gave us what I call a go-to-hell shot. And this thing backed off over in the corner, shut down like a jack-in-the-box. So I didn't hear nothing or didn't see nothing. I could roll my head a little bit, and I rolled it to the right, and I sensed a presence in there, kind of. And it was this alien woman that came out. But she looked normal. She looked to me like just a normal old redneck girl. And the only difference I could tell, her two middle fingers on each hand was a little longer. Hmm. Well, she kind of pinched me by the jaw a little bit, or kind of did it like your grandmother would. And then she grabbed my chin, pushed down with one hand, took the other hand, inserted it down my throat. And I was starting to gag and bleed. It felt kind of like she wanted to go up my nasal cavities. Well, it was choking me, and I was starting to bleed, and she pulled it out. Telepathically, she said, "We don't mean you no harm." But I was thinking, you know, lady, the harm's done. Hmm. And she pulled this out, and I was bleeding and all. And she summons that big ugly one, because I was fixing to leave there if I could. He come back over, grabbed me by the left arm again, gave me one more injection while I was on board the ship to settle me down. Then she kind of backed up out of the way a little bit. And that's when she made a little mumbling sound, like an alligator mating call that you'd hear down here. And it just travels all over the water, the vibration. And he jumped up and come and grabbed us and picked me up and escorted me out to ship and back to where we were originally picked up. And I was standing with my arms stretched out facing the water, and I couldn't put them down. And Charlie was on his hands and knees, and he got up and said, "You okay, son? You okay?" Well, by then it was all over, so it wasn't no need to panic. He said, "Let's sit down here and talk a minute." So we pulled up a log, sat down on the pier, and was talking. And said, "We need to let somebody know." Of course, back in, they didn't have cell phones or computers. And I said, "No, we don't need to let nobody know. I'm going to get up in the morning. I'm going to work. That's going to be the end of it, Charlie, and you do the same thing." This is kind of where Charlie and I had our splitting on all this. he said, okay. So we got up, went to the car. Well, on his side of the car, it was my car, but on his side, the passenger side, the window had shattered in place. And when we opened the door, it fell out. And I sat there and tried to crank that little Rambler and wound on it. The battery should have run down, but it didn't. Finally got it going. It was running rough and we left. Well, when we pulled out, I noticed a car that was there was still there, but I wasn't taking no time to visit. So we left and was going back to the apartments, and there was a little, some kind of little curb store over there that had a pay phone. Charlie said, stop here, let me make a call. Well, I thought he was going to call his wife, tell her we was a little late coming in. So I pulled up. We neither one had any change, a nickel, but he did manage to find a couple of nickels under the seat. He went to the payphone, and I didn't know he was calling Keesler Air Force Base at the time. And they told him to talk to the local sheriff department or the local law enforcement. And I still didn't know all this was going on. So he come back to the car, hunted another nickel, put it in the phone. He called the Jackson County Sheriff Department here in Pascagoula, Mississippi. They said, y'all stay right there. I know what they was thinking, because plus I had already talked to the man that answered the phone since then. So anyway, they showed up, and of course I was the one driving. They shined their little flashlight in the car, asked me to step out. Charlie's sitting there like a big possum. And I stepped out. He said, follow this light with your eyes. So I kind of followed that little light. He said, now here's what I want you to do. I want you to get on one leg, bend your head back, close your eyes, jump up and down, and touch your nose.
He wanted to see if you were drinking, obviously.
Yeah. And I said, hell, man, I couldn't do that if I was drunk. Much less sober. But anyhow, I took all the little sobriety tests. He said, look, you don't appear to be drinking anything. Why don't you get back in your car? Y'all come to the sheriff department, and we'll take y'all statement. So that's what I done. You know, by then, you didn't want to try to outrun the law. They had my tag number and all. Drove back to the sheriff department. Went in, they took Charlie in one room and took me in another room, and they was interviewing us. They were taping them interviews now, then, and I didn't know they was taping that part. Then they put us in a room together. And while we was in there, I noticed one of them walked in and kind of looked in a drawer, and he must have turned on a tape recorder.
Yeah.
Turned around and walked out. Well, then me and Charlie was talking about what happened. And a few minutes, the sheriff come up, and he must have went and got this tape. And the sheriff, Fred Diamond, said, look, I want to talk more about this, but y'all tired. We know y'all not drinking. Go home, go to bed, and I'll see y'all tomorrow. Well, I didn't really think they'd come out to the shipyard, so I took them at the word. I went home, took all my clothes off. Back in, they had paper bags, put them all in a paper bag because they was bloody. And I remember a long time ago, my mother used to wash me with bleach when we'd get poison ivy or something.
Mm.
So I thought bleach would cure all. There was a gallon of bleach on the back of the tub. I turned the shower on, got a little damp, poured that whole gallon of bleach over, rubbed it in.
Oh, that must have burned.
Oh, it did. It was terrible. So I got my shower and the bleach. Then I got out of the shower, slipped on some clothes, picked up my little paper bag, which that was a mistake then. I should have kept it, but they didn't have DNA back in.
Yeah.
So I carried it out and put it in the dumpster. Went in there and tried to go to sleep, but I couldn't sleep with all that going on.
I bet.
And got up the next morning. Charlie was sitting there. I said, "You ready for work?" I didn't know what he had told Blanche or not, so I didn't want to sit down and have to hear it. He said, "Yeah, let's go." So we was on our way to work. And when we got to work, I did notice one thing. They had all these telescoping TV trucks, and they had the uplinks on them straight up in the air so they could uplink to a satellite and, you know, spread the good news, I guess. But I didn't realize if this was normal or something the shipyard was doing or even what it was. So we brassed in and went inside. It wasn't just a few minutes. They called her name on the speaker to come in. And the owner of the shipyard, he said, "Look, fellas, we cannot conduct business like this. Y'all going to have to give a news release." I said, "Oh, shucks." I said, "Well, Charlie's the one going to have to give the news release." Well, Charlie and I had done talked about it. I didn't want to be involved. So the owner of the shipyard offered his attorney to come in and give help Charlie with a press release so they could get back on their phones and all. So they made up a press release. Joe Flamingo was the attorney. And it went from there. And then the sheriff showed up. He said, "I got to thinking last night about diseases, radiation, and all that. Y'all need to go to the hospital." So Dr. Bosco, which is still alive, and I think Phillip's trying to get a statement from him right now, but Dr. Bosco did the medical exam. He looked at her puncture marks on her own, checked her fever, you know, just roundabout stuff, did a little blood work. He said, "Well, I don't think, you know, y'all have anything to worry about. But y'all do need to go to Keesler and get a radiation test." Well, the sheriff said, "Well, I'm going to drive them there." Keesler was about 30 miles from there. Well, at the time Charlie talked to them, they didn't show no interest in nothing. So they drove us up to the docks. The docs told everybody to stay in the car and for me and Charlie to get out. They scanned us with something, not a Geiger counter, but one of them things to detect radiation, and decided that we really didn't have that much radiation. I had a little bit, but that came from me working in an oil field, handling these little radiation tablets, to go in these tools to calibrate them holes. So when they got through, he hauled all clear. He said, "Now they want to see you in the back office." Well, here we go, walking down the hall, one of them escorting us. They opened the office. That was the longest walk. They opened that office back there, and it must have been 100 people in there. It was military brass, every police chief from the three lower counties, ever patrolman, a lot of the patrolmen down there. So they walked in. They said, "We're going to do an interview." And they all did. I was kind of afraid to lie, but I still wasn't going to put myself out there on a limb because I didn't want no publicity. They got through and just as nice as they could be, they said, "Y'all can go." So we walked back out and got in a patrol car. And when we got back into the patrol car, Sheriff Fred Diamond said that there was somebody that wanted to see us for us to be sure and see him before we left. And that was Dr. Hynek and Dr. Harder back at the office. So they took us in. And Dr. Hynek interviewed me first. Dr. Harder interviewed Charlie. Then we switched places. But I felt comfortable around Dr. Hynek. It was kind of like talking to family, and I didn't know how my family was taking this. I knew news is broke. But I just come straight out with Dr. Hynek and talk to him. So he said, hang around till in the morning. So we done. We hung around, went back up there in the morning. And he was all upset because the police department didn't treat the place where this landed like a crime scene. And he said, where are you going to be the next few days? So I'm going to be home. You know, I hadn't talked to my family. I hadn't seen how they're doing. I got to go home. So he gave me his card with his phone number and told me to call him if I needed anything, wanted anything, wanted to talk about anything. Said, okay. So I left and went home. Well, my family never asked me about this, and it was all over the news. Fiance at the time, I was going to marry November the 9th. She never asked me. So I never talked about it. I just clammed up and didn't say nothing about it. So I went 46 years without talking about this to my family, my friends. And that's where Philip, my wife and Philip was wanting me to do a book. Now, she didn't know Philip at the time. But Philip had called me and said, look, this is your legacy and a way to open up with it, put it in writing. So that's when I decided to do it. I said, now look, Philip, one thing, I don't want nothing in this book edited, yeah. No words corrected. What it is what it is.
Yeah.
And if people don't like it, I don't care.
Good
so
for you.
We agreed on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Philip's good like that. And, he's been grateful of the connection. I still hear that from him, which is nice. I want to go, let's see, we can take calls, but it seems like there's so much, to talk about in this. Again, going back to the I'm at the transcript script right now, which actually is in the show notes for, those of you, listening. And, I'll have that link also over on YouTube. But there's, Charlie talks about what you sounded like you were talking about looked like a deck of cards. Is that what he called that looked something like an eyeball? The same thing?
Well, I've often wondered about that. See, Charlie and I never really sat down and talked much, just that I didn't want everybody to know. But from what I've seen, we had a sketch artist at the shipyard, and he drawed a camera-looking deal, said it looked like an eyeball. But, you know, that's all I know about what Charlie had seen.
But he was in another room, so he may have been scanned by something different than you were scanned.
Absolutely.
Or whatever that thing was that came down from the ceiling. Does he remember you talked about the female, you know, with the long fingers and that whole uncomfortable experience. Did he also talk about seeing the same female type being?
He didn't to me. Now, I don't know if he might have talked to somebody on the show. Now, he did describe the big ugly ones.
Yeah.
Downright. Matter of fact, him and that sketch artist, Larry Flint, got together and drawed the big ugly one. It looks just like him.
Yeah. I don't know if this is it or not, but you don't remember now, Charlie, even right then he was talking about the conical things, but he didn't focus on it like he did after. But, you don't recall that when the three beings that came out of the craft, when the craft opened up and they floated over to you, this is one thing I don't think you mentioned, that it was like they floated like a foot or something off of the ground. And you like floated, and he describes that when the sheriff is out of the room and the secret tape, he talks about being floated and carried around like he weighs nothing, you know.
Yeah. You'd figure it would hurt, you know. Of course, I didn't weigh much back in, 130 pounds. But you would think it would break your arm, just pick you up by your arm, but it was no pain whatsoever. And
yeah.
floated right over the top of that marsh grass.
Do you remember, were you upright when that was happening, or were you actually, you were?
No, I was upright.
Okay. You were?
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
And I can't even imagine this whole experience. And of course, in the transcript, it says how, you know, how you're a mess, basically. You don't know how you're going to get through this thing, and no one will ever believe you. You know, I mean, has that feeling been with you a long time? Like, how could anyone believe this actually happened?
Been with me 46 years, and that's the reason. I tell you what I was going to do. I was going to do that book with Philip, and I was going to buy 10 copies and give them to my family and friends and let them read about it in there so I wouldn't have to sit down and talk to them. I was really uncomfortable talking about all this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such an unbelievable story. Now, time goes by, and this goes pretty public. You've been interviewed a ton of times, and they're going to be making a movie. Is that right?
Well, anything's possible right now. I try to stay out of all the screenplays. All I know, we got what Philip calls a graphic novel coming out. And I've been taking a little interest in that because it's been pretty good and the artwork's good. Matter of fact, you showed some artwork on it when we first come in.
Jason Gleaves, who's been on this show in the past, made this diorama. I'm going to pull it up for the YouTube. I could put that in the show notes as well.
Okay.
You can see it up there on YouTube. That's the diorama and the three beings. Now, when Charlie's describing the beings, he said he didn't know if they had one leg or two. Did you get any type of look at them at all that you can remember?
Yeah, pretty good. Looked like their legs didn't have a seam down them, you know, where they could separate. But, you know, I don't see why they would need legs if they could float.
Which is so bizarre. I can't even imagine what was going through your mind when they started floating, coming toward you. I mean, I just can't even imagine. And when you actually saw them coming toward you, you had the river right there where you couldn't go anywhere, right? I mean, you could have gone to the side maybe or something.
No, that was no abandoned shipyard, and there was metal and concrete and all in it. I looked around, but I just didn't have time to figure an escape route.
Oh, so. Wow. I think what I'm going to do, I mean, I have a lot of questions to ask you, but I think I'm going to let the listeners call in, and I'm going to bring Bill in. And we are going to take calls. The number is 855-472-5483. And give a call. Ask your questions. Calvin's here. It's your opportunity. And I hope that Bill, you're all set. Just put in chat that you were all set for the calls. Yep, he is. All right. So the lines are open. Anyone can call in. Again, that number is 855-472-5483. So you ended up getting married. I met Waynette, wonderful woman. I really enjoyed, you know, spending time with you in Arizona. And what was her – did you talk to her about it? You know, you said you didn't when she was your fiance, but when you got married, is this – something that would come up over the years, or is this something you've had to bear all on your own, basically?
Never came up from none of my family or friends.
Wow.
They knew how I felt about things, and they respected my privacy.
The
only time I started talking about it with them was when that book came out, and I did give them all a book.
Oh, you did? You did do that?
Yeah, I ordered 10 books and I handed them out. So,
wow. All right. Well, we have people already. We have Mike from Cincinnati. Welcome to the show, Mike. Mike, can you hear me? Bill, it's not coming through.
Hello?
Mike, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, good. Phew. How you doing, Mike? You got a question for our guest?
Yes, Martin and Calvin, great show. And Calvin, you're a brave man. I appreciate what you've done. My question is, I know Charlie Hickson, I believe, went on the UFO circuit for a while speaking and everything, and used his money to make a movie about this. I was just wondering if you saw the movie that he made or had made, and if you agree with what was shown in that movie. I can't remember the name of it. I saw it a long time ago, but that's my question, and I'll hang up so other folks can call. Thank you all.
Thanks for the call, John.
But to answer your question, I never knew Charlie made a movie on it. I'd like to see it.
Oh, you never saw that? Well, let's see. The way these calls are coming in, that was Mike. I'm sorry. Mike from Cincinnati, I guess that's who that was. Mike, if you want to call back on that line and leave information with Bill, I'd appreciate it on where Calvin, and actually I would like to see that too. So now we have John from California. I'm not sure. Did I call him John before? We have John from California. You on the line, John?
Yes.
Hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'd like to ask Calvin a quick question, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's fine.
Hey, Calvin, I see a lot of similarities in your experience with the Travis Walton case. I know you've probably been told that a million times. Have you ever been able to, in the past, get together with Travis and compare notes, or did you see some similarities and what happened to you all?
Yes, so we got together. We both had booths at this conference in Phoenix. So I got to meet Travis and spend a little time with him. And he seems like a good, down-to-earth person. I don't know. But we didn't compare notes on what we had seen.
Well, you both seem very truthful to me. I applaud you for coming forward, and can't wait to read the book. And if they ever do make a movie about it, I'll be anxious to watch that. Best of luck to you all, and really appreciate you coming forward. Thanks so much, Calvin. Thank you, Martin.
All right, great.
Try to stay warm.
All right, we have Robin from Colorado. Robin, welcome to the show. Robin, are you there? Bill, we're looking for Robin from Colorado.
Actually, her call dropped, but maybe.
All right. How about Johnny Cobb, the guy who wrote the song, North Carolina?
You can bet he's cold now, too.
Yeah. Johnny, are you there?
Yes, I am, Warden.
Hey, Johnny. Hey, great song. Thank you for letting me play that on the break.
Oh, no, thank you and Calvin for playing that. I really do appreciate it. You guys sound great and look great, and I hope sometime this year, if there's another conference, that I can get a chance to take a picture of both of you guys.
That'd be awesome. Do you have a question? I know you talked to Calvin, but do you have a question for him tonight?
You know what? Every time I hear his story, I learn something new, and I just want everybody to know Calvin is the real deal. He's a gentleman and a wonderful person.
Yeah.
Thank you, Johnny.
I agree, Johnny. And keep making the music. Thank you.
You and Cal will be the first two people to hear our new music when we create it.
All right.
Take care.
Excellent. Take care now.
Okay.
All right. Goodbye. We have Simone. Simone from Arizona. Welcome to the show, Simone. You there, Simone?
Yes, sir.
Hi there. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. Hello. You have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. Hello, Calvin. I'd like to ask you if, and this is regarding UFO Witness episode six, you mentioned having an implant or the possibility of it. Have you ever had any type of scan or MRI done to rectify that?
Here, within the past 2 months, I had a MRI done, and I had mentioned for them to take a little time and look, and they didn't find nothing then. Of course, it could have been removed by then. It might not have never been one in there. But that's something I'm still looking into.
Wow, interesting. Anything else, Simone? Do you have any other questions? That was a really good question because I forgot all about that.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Mike called back, and he thinks the movie's name that Charlie Hickson did about the Pascagoula incident was called Beyond Contacts. We're going to have to check that out. I'll take a look. Thank you, Mike. Yeah, thanks for calling back, Mike. We have Robin. She's back. Robin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was just wondering if Calvin had a completely different paradigm shift after this had happened to him.
Well, I don't know what a paradigm shift is.
the whole way of life, your whole way of thinking.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I went into my own little world, and that's where I kind of stayed until the book come out. And the only reason it came out is because of Martin and Philip and my wife. And that was one of the best things that's happened to me.
Oh, that's amazing. And I also, if it's okay, if I have another question.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Did you, by any chance, after this experience, become more psychic in a way you never wanted to? And if so, how do you make it stop?
Well, there's times when you're, and I think everybody goes through this, when you go somewhere and you feel like you've been there before, you even know the outlay of the town, kind of. But I don't think any more than anybody else has.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and I look forward to reading your book. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling back. Yeah.
Bye.
Bye. I know. Yeah, we had a ton of callers all calling at the same time. Now the lines are open. Again, that number is 855-472-5483. Keep them coming in. Calvin, you mentioned on that episode, and I believe we might have talked about this when we were in Arizona, but you had another, something else happen to you. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, we don't have much time to get into it, but back in 1983, May of 83, I had another abduction case and actually got into a physical fight with the one that abducted me. But I had to go, when I left and went home, I had a friend that had been wanting me for years to talk to me, and he was with a TV station, a local station, and I would never do it. But when he came over, I told him a little bit of what happened. He said, hold on a minute. I've been looking this stuff up, and I know Bud Hopkins, and let's go see him. Well, Bud was doing a seminar in Florida, Tampa, Florida. So we loaded up. It's not but 12 hours from the house. Went to Tampa. He went in there and talked to Bud and told him who I was. I wouldn't go in and talk to him. I didn't want to be recognized. So I told him who I was. And he said, well, y'all go to my room. I'll be through here in a few minutes. So Bud gave him the key to the room. We went there and just let ourselves in. Well, when he got there, he talked me into letting him hypnotize me. And he did. And we went back. And then I followed up here not long ago with Kathleen.
Oh, Kathleen Martin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have Derek called in. And we only have 5 minutes left anyway. So, Derek, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much, Cal. Great show, and great to meet you, Calvin. Appreciate your story. And
Thanks.
Very interesting. Yeah, it's something that to marvel at. And try to keep it quick. The question I had was, I think Michael Stratt was on the show before, but he was good at detailing, or good historian, at bringing up various cases. But
yes.
I've been an independent researcher for quite some time, and yours is very outstanding from the standpoint of the beings. And I was wondering, within you trying to get or acquire some other answers associated with your experience, has there been any other close similarities to any other people that have had a similar type of experience with that type of being? Because it was really outstanding in how they looked and operated in being robotic. And I haven't heard anything else similar to that. So I was just curious where that was concerned. And I can take it.
Question.
I'm not for sure if I've seen anything any closer or not, because here lately I've been kind of concentrating on mine. But what I'd like to do is come back with Martin. And there's another episode in 1983. And I really want to get into that abduction there. Now, it tells a lot more detail. It just takes about an hour and a half to get into it.
We'll definitely do that.
Okay.
In the future. We'll definitely do that in the future. One of the and I'm going to pull the no more calls at this point. I do appreciate the people that called in. Thank you for doing that. Calvin, one of the things he just mentioned, there was another case where the beings they thought floated, and that's the Ariel school incident that happened in South Africa in 1994 or 5. I can't remember the year exactly. But they actually kind of said that they look like they're floating, but it also brought me to this question. The female being of the four beings that you encountered, was that being actually floating as well in the craft? Do you remember that?
No. I've often said, you know, she looked real normal with the exception of them two middle fingers, just like a little redneck country girl from down here in Mississippi and Louisiana. Matter of fact, that's...
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to talk about her because I've never really did. And I'm sorry for interrupting a little bit there, but how about hair and dress and things like that?
She had hair. It was... we have an artist. Philip and I have an artist that is doing a real pro picture on her. And we've worked together on it several times. It's just not really right now, but mm-hmm. I'll be glad when that photo gets here. But she was normal as far as I was concerned. I told my wife if I'd been somewhere drinking back when I was younger, I would have asked her out on a date.
But you would not after she put her fingers down your throat.
No, not after she kind of gagged me there a little
yeah.
bit.
So color hair, was it blonde, brown, red?
It was kind of a bluish blonde. It's really hard to describe.
Oh, ahead of her time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And clothing, do you remember that?
Yeah, she had on a jumpsuit. And as far as breast, she wasn't really blessed with none of them that I could see. So,
okay, maybe that's not usable on their in their evolution.
Might not be.
that's pretty funny, Calvin. We are at the end of the show, and I definitely want to get you back in. We'll talk about that that whole thing that happened in 1983. You were on your boat, though, right, or something like that? Isn't that how it started?
I was on my boat fishing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when it all started.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Calvin. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Martin.
All right. You
appreciate
take care.
It.
All right. Talk soon. And take care of yourself. All right. All right, everyone. Thank you so much. We'll be back next week with Miguel Romero, Red Pill Junkie. And thank you so much for watching the show and participating, calling in, all that stuff. I really appreciate it. And remember, everyone, to keep your eyes to the sky.